Hello and welcome. This is Jutta. He fully completed academia, so actually he's a doctor. And
Jesus.
Nowadays people give him money to do data science, and since he's a biomathematician by trade, by training, I guess.
By training, yes.
He was asking himself, well, actually, maybe not always Python, maybe functional programming. How would that look like? And he'll brought that to us and will tell us about that. And please have a warm welcome for Jutta.
Yeah, thank you so very much. I think after all that nice introduction, I'm perfectly set up to disappoint, but bear with me. Yeah, that was already said. I started out as a biologist, and I fell down the math rabbit hole and became a biomathematician. And yeah, I completed academia until the bitter end, and then I said, yeah, okay, thanks. And the math part of my education has instilled me with this really great interest in writing code where you can maybe prove or at least be reasonably certain that it kind of does what it's supposed to do, for which functional programming is a good tool. And yeah, as mentioned, I do something with data, both in industry and also in the context of multiple nonprofits. So that's the stuff I do both in my work time and also in my free time. Also, as an obvious disclaimer, while I do lots of coding, I never had a proper software engineering practice, so I cannot really talk about to you with like this best practice, continuous integration, testing, whatever. This is like all the stuff I'm not particularly good at. So take everything I say with maybe one or more grains of salt. So as a tiny little backstory, how I ended up here actually is, well, the problem of mine is I'm not really able to shut my face, which means I gave a talk on functional programming multiple times. It's two times on the Media CCC page. In fact, I gave it three times. Hackover is sadly still missing, which I think is sad because on the Hackover day, I had a really great day, so I still consider this like the version of record. Sadly, it seems to be lost due to time. I'm not really as expecting this to crop up at any time, but I guess that's how it is. And realizing it's been the third time I gave this talk, I really, really quickly on a whim added this one slide at the very end because I figured, hey, I have given like this introduction to functional programming so often now, and I would maybe like to talk about something somewhat different. And I had this random idea. Actually, a friend of mine, Foxy, who's sitting all the way back in the end, had this idea that you're doing data science all the time and you love FP, why not try to like cross these streams? And then I very briefly punched in that slide a few minutes, I guess, before giving the talk and said, yeah, hey, you know, FP and data science can like kind of go hand in hand, and there might be at some point a talk about that. Then we submitted an abstract also very hastily, and as it turns out, people wanted to see that. So then, I had to make slides in the last days. Haven't had any possibility to exercise this talk either, so we'll see how this goes. So as a, like this is like the one, I would say, political slide here, as which you always have to expect in any chaos talk, I guess. I guess we all agree that data and data analysis really today plays a crucial role, and nobody really can live without being touched by the consequences of data and data analysis doing their things. So if you like briefly brainstorm a bit, you'll find that, of course, lots of things that the government does, lots of things in policy making, the whole healthcare sector, everything businesses does, stock exchanges, international trade, everything is somehow affected by data. So this is something we cannot really close our eyes to. The problem is that despite this crucial role, data analysis often can turn out to be ridiculously wrong. And I always like to start my talks with like stories of fuck-ups to like have a little bit of a motivation why we should bother. And this one story that came to my mind instantly because it's so funny, but if you think about it, it's also really terrible. There was a few years ago, 2010, this paper by two people. C.M. Reinhardt is a woman. I'm not quite sure from which university she was, but the second author was some very eminent professor of macroeconomics at Harvard University, so by all means, apparently very clever guy. He wrote this paper, Growth in the Time of Debt, in 2010, and since then it has accumulated 5,500 citations, which is absolutely incredible. It's like one of those papers that many, many people apparently have read. And this actually also influenced public policy by a lot. Because to abbreviate the story, I'll briefly show a little crop from that. He basically asked the question, how much debt should a government take on to still guarantee the economy kind of keeps running? Because I guess, obviously, if you're like completely in debt and cannot pay anything anymore, then that's, I guess, kind of bad for society. And to cut a long story short, what his conclusion was, is this part here, that apparently you can go to approximately 90% of your gross domestic product. If your debt stays below that line, then apparently everything seems to work out nicely. But if you cross that line, then according to his, let's call it the data analysis, stuff starts to go down the drain. And then there was this very funny story when a student in an undergraduate course at some nondescript university had this summer project. His professor told him, yeah, maybe read this paper. This is a very good paper, and lots of politicians regularly use that paper to influence policymaking. Just look at the analysis and try to replicate it, and yeah, then you will learn a great deal about data analysis and public policy. As it turns out, he did learn a great deal about data analysis and public policy, but not quite in the way it was intended to, because the entire summer he had complete problems to replicate it. His results were always completely different. And his professor was like, dude, come on, it ain't that hard, right? Just get this running, show me the number, it should be 90, then you're good to go, you get a good grade, and we can go home. And he tried, and he tried, and he tried. Asked around, got input from other people. And at some point, I read the story in an interview with him. He said he looked at the source of this paper, at the analysis, and he couldn't believe his eyes. And he asked his roommate at college, in his college dorm, said, guy, could you please come over and take a look? Am I seeing this right, or is my brain frying? Because what he saw is the supplement of this paper, where the data analysis was carried out in Excel, as it turns out, that's what they apparently use for professors in Harvard, MS Excel. And he saw this cell here. There was some average that was calculated across different countries. And if you take a closer look where this formula applies to, you see something quite interesting. And I couldn't resist doing like this PowerPoint 101 thing and add the dramatic red arrow. I first wanted to let it fly in from the left, but I said, no, I've got to be professional, just let it appear. And as you can see by now, hopefully, the formula stops here and it excludes five different countries. If you do the analysis again properly, what you actually notice is that this number is complete nonsense. In fact, you can, and you should, take on a little bit more debt because you can use it for investments, and that in turn stimulates economical growth. So this means a lot of public policy, both in the US and also in the EU, that were influenced by this analysis, were not at all evidence-based. They did quite the opposite. So I guess that's a good motivation to see that data analysis can and will impact all of us at some point of time, either directly or indirectly. And my main thesis here is that if we apply some functional programming, or at least some principles and concept from this world of FP, then I guess, or in my opinion, we can do some stuff somewhat better. Obligatory disclaimer, of course, writing robust analytical code is not exactly the same as writing in functional programming. You can still do very, very nasty things in FP, and of course you can still write reasonably good code without using any functional programming. However, it makes certain parts easier and it makes certain errors harder to commit. So in a way, I would say on average, it kind of is a good thing. And while we talk about quite a few very interesting concepts from this world of FP, this is not really an introduction talk to functional programming itself. The other talk I showed earlier, this is really an introduction to Haskell, geared at like a complete newcomer. Here, we will instead talk more about concepts that you can apply in basically nearly every other language. So the idea is to say, well, if you think some of these things I mentioned are, in your opinion, useful and cool, you can take them and run with them and use them in your own practice, but there's no need to fully commit to and spend all the time and investment in learning whatever, Haskell or whatever, and only working in Haskell from now on. And if we ask our favorite online encyclopedia of choice what exactly functional programming is, we end up with this very, very long article with many, many words. Quite a few words crop up over and over again. I just briefly show some highlights here. We will not have to read through this thing. Instead, what I try to do is I kind of took these and tried to group them together by theme. And the too long didn't read of this article is FP offers quite a few of things that, in my opinion, makes life for us substantially easier. So one thing you will read over and over again in the article is that apparently functions play a crucial role in functional programming. Who could have thought? Some other things you see is repeated over and over again that your functions should be small and something that's called pure. We will be talking about purity in a few minutes, quite a bit, because this is really a concept that makes stuff really, really easy. Ideally, these functions should also be written in what's called a declarative style. This is a little bit hard to rigorously define. It's more like a bit of a feeling, and I will illustrate that with an example later. And like I said, these things act together to make it easier to look at the function and convince ourselves that a function indeed does what we hope it would be doing. And the second thing that crops up over and over again is applying and composing functions in a kind of modular manner, maybe like an engineer would put together a bunch of different cogs and chains and whatever to construct an engine of a race car. This again allows for this declarative style about which we will talk in a second, and makes it easier to really reason about how the different parts of the code will interact and convince ourselves that they interact in a way that we would hope they do. And this also touches upon something that is always said, that functions in functional programming are first-class citizens. In other words, they're super important and like the main actors, the main thing you will interact with. We will also talk about that in a few seconds. So maybe let's start with functions. And now I will briefly orient myself along this outline for something I guess you could call a bit of a theoretical part. And afterwards, we'll have also a more practical part where I show like a little toy example of how you may be able to approach a typical little tiny toy data science project applying some principles I will mention in the theoretical part. So let's start with functions. And I think, from my experience, it is easier to use a little bit of a didactic example. And this example function doesn't really come from the world of data science at all, but it is still quite useful because it is very small. It is quite easy to understand what we are trying to do, and it fits comfortably on one single slide. And so it will also comfortably fit in our brain, and we can reasonably think about that together here without having like to think too hard. And this little toy example I always keep using is checking for a string, or checking whether a string is a palindrome. Just briefly reminder for those who might have forgotten, a palindrome is, of course, a string that when you read it forwards, it's the very same as when you read it backwards. So if your text is ABCBA, you read it backwards, you end up with ABCBA. So quite obviously, ABCBA is considered a palindrome. So let's just first imagine very naively, maybe imagine it's like 20 years ago, we are writing in C because that's what people mostly did, or maybe 30 or 40 years ago. How would we implement such a function? Because I don't want to like annoy you with C code, I have written this here instead in a very naive Python way. How maybe somebody who is trained in C might intuitively... we have a professional C programmer here. Disclaimer, I love C. I like working in C quite a lot. I do not want to badmouth C. It's like just to prime our mindset to say, let's imagine we are all C programmers and try to write this down like we've been taught at university 40 years ago in an imperative style. So we would define a function as palindrome, takes a string, it could also take any other list of digits or whatever, and ideally at the end it should return a Boolean, either true or false. For convenience, what we first could do is we could write the length of the string in memory, because we will refer to that n a few times, so maybe let's start somewhere. And then I guess the obvious choice would be that we would like to have some kind of loop. We loop through this string and we compare the very first character with the very last one. We check, are they the same? If yes, we continue. Then we look at the second one compared with the second to last, and so on and so on and so forth. If at any point we notice a discrepancy, we can instantly abort and say, nope, it's not a palindrome. However, if we made it through the loop, we can safely say, yes, they're all equal. The string indeed seems to be a palindrome. And this is not too bad as an implementation. It is quite good. It has some things going for it. So the first good thing is this function is pure. So I guess that's the time where we can again talk a little bit about purity. So purity is one of those concepts that's really central in functional programming. And what it means is anything that happens inside of the function is not affected by anything that happens anywhere else in your code base on the outside. And vice versa, anything that happens in the function does not leak any so-called side effects that may influence what happens elsewhere. So the function is completely decoupled. And this is a very nice thing because it allows us to only consider this function in isolation and only look at this function to convince ourselves or to answer the question whether the function does what it should be doing. We don't have to care about any global variables that may have been influenced by any other function in your code base at any other point of time that may somewhat interfere with what the function is doing. And this function quite certainly is pure because it doesn't affect and it does not rely on any global state. And this is good. The function is also pretty smallish. We will make it way more small in a few seconds, but this is smallish. It's a good starting point. So this is also nice because it makes it easy to understand what is happening. The question is this function really easy to verify? Well, I guess kinda if we read through it line by line. And in fact, there's one obvious, I would say, weak point, namely this indexing here. Because actually, when I wrote down this function, I myself made instantly an off by one error. So even the person who tried to construct an adversarial example to point out something, well, is not safe from off by one errors. Because you always have to think about, well, is it zero or one based indexed? We have to, the string is n characters long, and we want the last one, so that has index n minus one. So we have to start with n minus one, and then we have to subtract the index. It's not like you look at this and instantly say, yep, that's right, or no, this is obviously wrong. We have to spend a few seconds at least thinking, and we try to avoid thinking. Ideally, we just want to look at it and say, yes, it looks good. Okay, so it's kind of easy to verify, but not really well. And finally, we also technically have a bit of mutable state in here, namely this n. We have written something to memory, we call this variable n, and we refer back to it two lines later. So by definition, we have some state here. And it might sound a little bit unintuitive for people who aren't used to FP, but ideally, in my perfect world, I would try to avoid state whenever and wherever possible. Move away with it entirely. Because the problem is, if we have a huge function that's, imagine we have a bad function that's 200 lines long, and we change some state in line 3, and later in line 97 refer back to that state, it is quite likely that we haven't really thought this through, and there might be any danger at some point that we have changed the state in another position. And then it makes it really hard to understand what's happening. And if we have a bunch of mutable state and lots of different parts of the code acting upon it, reading it, changing their behavior based on what's in there, this is a recipe for at some point making some nasty error. This will happen. It is just a consequence of our brains not being perfect. I say technically yes, because in this case, it is so tiny and it is so obvious that n is the number of characters. So here, I guess, it's not something that induces lots of annoyances and grievances and headaches. But still, technically, this is an example for a mutable state. And in a perfect world, I would try to always avoid that. So let's enter FP and ask ourselves if we still want to stay in the Python world, but do it in a more functional, inspired way. How could we make this function better, in my opinion, or different? So let's think about again first, well, our function still should take some string and should return some Boolean. That's quite obvious. But let's try to put the essence of being a palindrome in, I guess, words as easy as possible. So let's just try examine ourselves to be immensely lazy and try to come up with the shortest possible, the laziest answer possible, what makes a string a palindrome. Well, as we have said earlier, when we are given the mathematical definition, it is a string that if you read it forwards, gives you the same as when you read it backwards. And that's basically all there is to it. Well, then why just write it down like that? And then we have one single line. This weird bracket, double colon minus one, might be a little bit confusing for those of you who aren't used to do much work in Python. It is just a shorthand for read the string backwards. We could have also just said s equals reverse of s. I don't think there's a native reverse function, so we would have to implement it somewhere, but whatever. It's in Python, it's called a string slicing. It just means take the whole string, but stride through it in steps of minus one. So go through it backwards. And that's all there is. This is, by definition, what makes a string a palindrome. Something, when you read it forwards, is the same as when you read it backwards. And this certainly is a very, very small function. It certainly, again, is very pure. And now we can say, yes, that's written in a style I would call declarative, because this is really the most lazy possible answer. And it basically is equivalent to the mathematical definition of being a palindrome. And in this way, we can look at it and say, yes, s equals the reverse of s. That must be true. There is no imaginable way how we can make like an understanding error here, because that's how we define what a palindrome is. And finally, we also eliminated that little bit of mutable state. Like I said, it wasn't that terrible, but we don't now write at any point something in memory which we refer back to, and we eliminated this danger of confusing ourselves. Why should we bother in the context of FP about all of that stuff? Well, obviously, small functions are easier to think about and verify. We just saw that. And of course, also, if we want to do some testing or if we have to do some debugging, if your function is short, then that becomes somewhat easier. And even more so, of course, pure functions, because you can look at them in isolation and think about only the function and the function alone, and don't have to hurt your head thinking about what happens at any other point in your code base. And if you avoid mutable state, it makes it even easier. And all of this stuff will become especially important in a few minutes when we'll think about having somewhat more complex numerical calculations. For instance, like we saw on the table, where we have a bunch of numbers and we perform multiple different transformations of that. Then if you have some pure functions that you just string together, then that's way more easy to verify as opposed to having a bunch of loops after one another that all do weird stuff with many different variables. And you wouldn't, I hope, you wouldn't quite believe what you can see in some scientific code and in many, many papers appendices. You, like, for instance, when you look at papers from the field of biology where they analyze single cell data sets, then you see these monster codes, one single function, multiple hundred lines. You start with variables, you copy stuff back and forth. The variables have completely unintelligible names. You copy stuff back and forth. Depending on the content of variables, you branch back and forth. You go to here and there. You have ifs, you have fors. And it is completely unintelligible to understand what happens unless you spend many hours reading through every line, adding comments. It is basically entirely impossible to reproduce that in any easy-to-do way. So this is something, this machinery or this way of thinking and approaching a problem makes these things way easier. Okay, so that was the first topic, having functions. Now we have functions, they're all small, we have accurately verified them, we have convinced ourselves these tiny functions do what they want. Like I said, we can maybe think about them like an engineer would think about cogs. They're standardized metal parts, they exactly do what they should, they all fall within a certain set of specifications. We can ensure this cog will always rotate at that speed or whatever, has so many teeth. And we can now put them together to build something we actually want to build. And now we enter the field of function application. And this is one of those words that sound very, very smart, but actually is a very, very simple concept. So function application means, well, duh, we apply a function to something, an argument or a set of arguments. We have now an immensely complicated example taken from the world of higher mathematics. Looks like that. We have this function f that takes a number x, and what it returns is 3 times x. And quite obviously, if we apply this function f to the argument 5, what happens is we replace this here, 3 times 5. Obviously, I hope we are all on the same page there. This will return 15. We have just applied our function f to an argument x. Put differently, and I guess a programmer would say, well, yeah, we have called a function and we have provided an argument. Why actually do we bother about thinking this? Why is there a whole slide about that? This is super trivial, isn't it? Well, first of all, data science is all about doing something with data. We get a bunch of data in, and of course we have to do something with that. We don't just want to look at the table and nod and say, oh yeah, nice, lots of data. We want to do something with it. So we want to apply functions to data. And I'm sorry. Yeah, I should have rehearsed more. I'm sorry. We have an example for that that shows why thinking about application of functions actually in a little rigorous way, as I've just done, actually goes pretty long way. So imagine for a brief second the, I would say, pretty horrific example that we are working in some kind of tax office and we are now bookkeepers and have to calculate what Germans call the Mehrwertsteuer. In English, it's the, I looked it up last night actually because I wanted to translate it. It's called the value added tax, VAT. And imagine we are tax lawyers and we are trying to look for a legal loophole. We have to now calculate VATs for many, many, many numbers. I'm sorry. It's an illustrative example. I know it's a horrible one, but it keeps you tense. And so you will follow the slide. So naively in Python, what would we do? Well, we have an input array of prices. We have an array we allocate where we want to return our result, and then we loop through all the prices. We always take the current one, we calculate a multiplication of 19%, that's the usual VAT in Germany, and we append the result, and at the end we return the results, and obviously this will work quite nicely. But it's quite a lot of bit of stuff going on here. So what we are doing here in a more formal way is we apply a function to a bunch of different elements. And this is something that is a pattern that happens in functional programming over and over again. In fact, this is such a crucial cornerstone that for this pattern there is an established name. It's called a map. I guess it is called a map because it is called a map. It's just something you have to accept. I don't think there's any smart reason why it's called a map, but it is called a map. How would we use this concept of a map in a like functional-inspired Python? Well, of course, we obviously again have some kind of input, and then we just need one single line that may look a little bit confusing at first, so we will go through it really chunk by chunk. But it will turn out to be, I would say, pretty easy, and also with a little bit of a trained eye, pretty intuitive. So first, please ignore this weird list on the outside. This is just to convert the result back in a list, because Python is a bit weird and returns a map object instead of a list. So ignore the list. First of all, this works nicely. The result is the same. But what exactly happens? Well, we call a function that is aptly named map, because that's what we want to do. And this map function takes two things as arguments. The first argument is, of course, our input array. So that's the array we want to map over. And the second input, that might look a little bit confusing at first, is the function that we want to map. And this is an anonymous function here in Python. You use this, it's called lambda. It just means we have a function, and this function doesn't really have a name here, that's why it's anonymous. And we pass this function as an argument to map. And this function takes some input x and returns a product of x and 19%. So, like I said, at the end, we just have to put a list around it, because what this returns in Python is a map object. This is some OOP stuff I don't really like, so we want to cast it back to a list. And like I said, this may look a little bit weird at first, but this is really a cornerstone of something you do in FP all the time. Like I said, you provide the function as a parameter. This is also something that you do quite a lot of times, so often that there's also a name for that. You are using what's called a higher order function. And the very nice thing is, if you understand that, you don't have to do this loop thing and you have to iterate through a loop and whatever. You just say, well, I understand that I'm applying a function to many, many different numbers. And because the function is pure, we can do that all independently of each other. Then it's immediately obvious that this is something you can automatically parallelize without having to think. So imagine we have our database not with, what is 4, but instead 4 billion prices, because we are as they call it in auditing, a bulge bracket. We are a company that does bookkeeping for Microsoft or whatever, and we have 5 billion numbers. Well, it's quite obvious to understand that we can distribute that task on many, many cores. And we can now cut up this 4 billion element arrays into how many cores our bookkeeping supercomputer might have, distribute that, perform all these calculations independently, at the end throw them back all together, and we got the same result. So this is another advantage of using this map approach to doing that. You can immediately see this is trivially to parallelize, and like I said, it also is one single line, and if you have seen it a few times, then you immediately understand, yeah, the intention of that is we have an array, and we throw all of the array elements in this function. Don't have to really think about having this loop and iterating through and appending stuff and whatever. It makes it way more easier to see what you intended to do. So now we have seen one cornerstone in functional programming. I would like to show you also a second one. And imagine, again, we are still working in our weird text bookkeeping office thing, and we are now tasked to do something else. Imagine we are supposed to find the small elements of an array. Let's just come up with a working hypothesis of small being less than 2 euros. Because, I don't know, maybe there's some weird legal tax loophole that we don't have to do much bookkeeping for prices below 2 euros and we can save some taxes or whatever. So, doesn't matter why, but we're supposed to find these. Okay, so we want to select all prices that are less than 2 euros, and in naive Python, you will again do some kind of loop. You will loop over all the prices to check, well, if it's smaller than 2 euros, okay, that's nice, then we can append it. At the end, you end up with this subset of elements. But subsetting is also something you do a lot in functional programming and also, of course, in data science. You always want to consider certain elements of your database. You want to consider certain entries. You want to exclude other ones. And in functional programming, you also do that a lot. So there's also an established name for that. It's called a filter. I guess that name makes somewhat more sense than map, because you filter out elements that fulfill a certain condition. And in a functional programming-inspired Python, you would do that, again, with a weird one-liner. Again, please ignore the list on the outside, because the filter command returns in Python a filter object, which is, again, some OOP stuff. I don't quite understand why they don't just return a list. I don't care either. But what you want to do is you call filter. You provide, again, your input array, prices. And you, again, provide an anonymous function that, in functional programming lingo, you would also call a predicate. That's, I guess, one of these smart words you can remember to throw around. And that function evaluates to either true or false and tells you whether to retain that element or not. And at the end, you end up again with this array smalls, where all the small numbers are in. And like I said, filter is like another cornerstone of FP. Like I said, we only want to retain those elements that fulfill a certain predicate. And of course, obviously, this is also something that's immediately obviously parallelizable. Why should we bother about these things? Well, like I said, in data science, we select and we transform elements all the time. And abstracting these manual processes with loops and working with arrays into a single concise line, a single concise call, of course, it saves repetitive code, and it also makes it way more easy to convey what actually your meaning is. You said, well, I want to filter out all those people in my data set that exceed the age of, I don't know, 18 years old, and I want to select only those people that earn more money than so-and-so, because I only need those four analyses I want to carry out. And once we chain together multiple steps, which we will do in the more practical session in a few seconds, it becomes really, really obvious why this is a nice thing to do. And of course, like I said, both of these things offer a very nice way of parallelizing that automatically without spending any brain power. So it makes it also very, very easy to deal with much larger data sets. So the last thing I want to talk about as part of the theoretical part is function composition, which is again one of those smart sounding words that actually are used to say something that's pretty obvious to everybody who has done some programming. Composition just means we string together a bunch of functions and get a new one. I have stolen this picture from Wikipedia that comes from some math article that tries to express that with like sets and mappings between them. So you have one function f that maps numbers a to numbers b, and then you have another function that maps b to c. And what you can do is you can like chain these two mappings together. In math lingo, you would write this as g and then this little circle and then f. And the key insight here is that this is now one single function that does not store anything anywhere in memory. It is one function with one input and one output. And that's actually what's called function composition. And of course, like I said, data science heavily relies on such change transformation. So you start up with some numbers, you want to do some first step, maybe you want to like, I don't know, exclude some outliers. Then you want to scale this maybe to the interval of 0 to 1. Then you want to, I don't know, do some other operations. It doesn't matter. But the thing is, this happens quite often in data science. And a bit of an anti-pattern that you often see when you start with doing data science is that people start with a data frame df. It's like an input table. And then they say, well, df1 is the data frame with all the people above 18. Then df2 is take df1 but exclude that. Then df3 and so on and so forth. At the end, you have 18 different data frames and completely lost track of actually what is happening. And this is something we can easily avoid with chain transformations. Little remark here on the side for those of you who are passionate about type systems. At this point, also strong type systems in FP come into play because this allows us to catch many errors we already make at that stage. Sadly, it is a bit out of scope here. If you care about type systems a lot, feel free to check out the other talk. I talk quite a bit about them there. Either way, the sad thing is that native Python doesn't have a built-in operator for function composition, which I think is a bit sad because while you can write something like that with lots of brackets, that's not really, really easy to read. In contrast, in Haskell, you have this dot operator to chain functions together. It's an inbuilt operator. And even in R, you can load a library that has this weird-looking operator. It's called the pipe. It's a percent, then a greater than, and then again a percent. It looks a bit ugly, in my opinion, but it's at least an operator you can use to chain together functions. And as much as I really love Python, and as much as I don't love R too much, I think using R syntax for the little practical example here will make it a little bit easier to understand for those of you who don't really have much experience with FP yet. So that's why the practical session I will briefly show you now, a little toy data science project, will use R instead. For those of you who don't love R like I do, I apologize for putting you through this. But like I said, I think there's a didactic reason. I think for a beginner, it is a bit easier to understand. Okay, so let's make a little excursus to a practical example, and after that, we're already done. And one of those really nice toy data sets that everybody who ever did data science knows is, of course, a data set related to this old ship that does not exist anymore, quite obviously. It's the RMS Titanic. And at its first big trip, it instantly sank. We all know the story. Many of us probably have seen the film. I have seen the film, but I slept through it at some point. So I didn't quite found it that entertaining, but the RMS Titanic gave us a beautiful toy example that every FP newbie uses, and it is quite nice, so we will do that too. Let's take first a brief look at the data set, and what we see is we see all the passengers, like 600, 700 something, not quite sure. And for every passenger, we have quite a few information, so we have like this ID, which is like just a running index. We have this variable whether he or she survived or not. We have the class first, second, third, or people who work there. It's another class. We even have a name, we have sex, we have age, we have some other things, number of siblings and spouses. Not sure what parch means. We have the number of the ticket, how much they paid for it, even the cabin, and at which port they embarked. And of course, ideally, when we do data science, we should first have a question and then look at data. But we did it the other way around. We first have looked at the data, and now let's try to come up with a question. And a very, very simple question, I guess, that's immediately obvious, is we could ask ourselves whether survival differs between men and women. And everybody who has seen the film or who knows history knows that there was this typical drill. It even has a name and a Wikipedia page, women and children first, because that's what like people believed back then, that women always should go first because they're the weak sex and whatever. And maybe it might be interesting to see whether we see that reflected in the data. But as we have just seen, there's quite a bit of confounding going on. So we have seen passengers belong to different classes, three different classes for customers and another staff class. And this, of course, may confound our results. We can probably expect that first class people survived somewhat more because they probably had, I guess, priority access to the lifeboats. And maybe if the first class was, I don't know, predominantly filled with men instead of women, that may alter our results. So I guess as a first step, we just focus on the first class. Why not? Of course, at the end, we would have to repeat the analysis for the other classes and see if it's robust, but that's out of scope. Another thing, children versus adults may certainly also confound our results because, as I've said, the drill was women and children first, and assume we have many, many, many male children, then this would, of course, also skew the numbers. So maybe for now, also just only look at legal adults. And the final thing, of course, is that the age of a person may very well influence the survival as well. So imagine you're a frail 75-year-old gentleman that can barely move, then I guess it's reasonable to assume that his chances at survival may have been smaller than, I guess, a person in his prime age of 25 or something. So this is something that makes it a tiny little bit more involved, and we solved the problem by just ignoring it for now. We'll think about that later. So what we want to do is we want to chain together our pipeline of function calls to do all the things that we just decided we want to do. And the nice thing is we will do this without any mutable state, without any DF1, DF man only, DF man only, but only first class, and so on and so forth. We'll make it in one single pipeline. And it looked like that. Let's go through it line by line. We start, of course, with our data set that's stored in the variable Titanic. Then we do what I've explained a bit earlier. We do a filter. We filter only those elements that belong to passengers from the first class, because we said we want to start with the first class. Then we chain together the next step, which is another filter, where we only look at legal adults, here defined as people exceeding, actually it should be less, it should be greater or equal to 21, not larger than 21, but whatever. You've seen I've written the slides late at night. And at the end, what we do is also this select. This is like just a shorthand for an R. It's like just something that means we select to only look at the column sex and survive. Because you saw there were a bunch of other columns, but I wanted to keep the slides a bit small. So at the end, this is like just for convenience because these are the two only columns we care about. And if we just look at these many hundred entries, I guess we could say, yeah, female survived, male not, female did. Oh, a male survived, then the next males did not. So there seems to be some trend going on already, as we could have suspected. And let's summarize this using the very nice command table. And then we get this cross table that summarizes the two columns that are present. And what we can see is out of these 69 women, all of them except two were able to survive. For the men, it looked quite opposite. Most of them died. Okay, so apparently there seems to be really, as we could have expected, an influence of sex on survival. And then we can now talk about the problem we've just ignored earlier, the problem of age. So let's think again about what we actually want to see or want to test. Our idea or working hypothesis earlier was that age may influence the survival because very old people may be somewhat more frail. And of course, very young people, children, would have been, I guess, would have had larger chances due to this drill of women and children first. We have already seen, however, that sex really crucially influences the survival. So for this reason, it might make sense to split the analysis into men and women. And let's start with men. We would, of course, at the end have to repeat the analysis for women. And this time we'll use data from all three classes, because if we only look at the first class, it was actually quite a small data set, and we just assume for now that this effect of sex on the survival should be approximately similar in all the classes. Of course, we would at the end have to do some kind of robustness check to make sure it's really that case, but we just assume it for now. And what we also do is we take this variable age that has all the different numbers from, I guess, 1, 2, 3, all the way to, I don't know, 70-something, and group it into blocks of 10, because that just removes some noise by bracketing people into a few classes. And how do we do that? Well, first, like I said, we want to filter again. We filter and want to only retain people that have a male sex. Then we pipe that into the mutate command. And between you and me, there are people called it mutate, but what's behind a mutate is just a map. But don't tell the R people, it's a mutate. And what we mutate here is we actually perform this operation here. The command is called cut, and what cut does is it takes a variable, in this case age, and cuts it into different intervals. And I opted here for grouping it at intervals of 10, so 0 to 9, 10 to 19, and so on and so forth. And at the end, we only want to look at these two columns again. Oops, I'm sorry. And we indeed see that if we consider this data set, well, we see, of course, we have for every passenger, we have the age bracket he or she belonged to and the survival status. So this is, again, a very, very long list, and we want to aggregate it into a table. And in the table, you indeed see quite nicely that depending on the age bracket, there seems to be something happening. So for small children, from excluding 0 years, including 10 years, you see somewhat more than half of them survived. Like I said, for males, of course. In the next age bracket, this trend has already reversed. Most of them died, and it becomes even worse for 20 to 30-year-olds. At the end, numbers become somewhat small, so it is quite hard to really see what's happening here. At the end, we have 4 versus 1, so here would say we got even a survival of 20%. That will be an outlier, as you see in a few seconds. But just looking at the numbers might be helpful to also calculate the probability. So what we add here is this block of 2 lines, and that's the last thing we will do, actually. We say we want to do, the R people call it a summarize. It just means we want to like somehow aggregate the data by calculating a survival probability, and because survival is coded as 0 or 1, we can just calculate the arithmetic mean. And if we do so, then what we end up with, oh, it's already there. I'm sorry. It's already there what we end up with. We see the survival probability for every age bracket, and we see in the beginning it's really good. Then it drops down, meanders a little bit around here. For very old people, it dropped down to 7%. And then here at the end, we have this class where only 5 people were in. So this is definitely an outlier that would come with a huge error bar. So just ignore that. But what we see is, on average, with some noise, it goes down. So as expected, older people indeed seem to have, I guess, a somewhat biological disadvantage of being able to survive such a tragedy. And as a little wrap-up, I guess I have 2 points to say. The first thing is, I would argue that functional programming, as I've already teased it in the last talk, lends itself quite nicely for data science, because having small and pure and very declarative, laconic function is just something that helps us to verify what is happening, and of course to also test and debug. Avoiding mutable states by having many, many different tables in memory and referring back and forth between them makes it somewhat easier for us to not lose track and not confuse ourselves along the way of a larger data science project. And as I've already stated multiple times, typical data science workflow is all about taking a bunch of raw data, filtering out some people, filtering out maybe some noise, apply transformations to certain variables, and ultimately, as we have just seen, aggregating the results of that pipeline into some tiny table or tiny number that we can interpret. And this is, like I said, something that, and I hope I was able to somehow convince you, that we can do quite nicely with typical FP commands and workflows. However, it is of course not a magic bullet. I guess the most obvious problem is the learning curve, especially in the beginning, is somewhat steep. You have to learn some new concepts, like you get exposed to weird names, like what the hell is a map, or what are we doing, why is there only one line, why does it look so weird? Especially if you're really used to imperative or God forbid, OOP programming. However, I would argue it is still worth doing it. And another thing is, you always have some side effect as soon as you interact with the real world, because a program that's 100% free of side effects is just running on the processor and just wasting CPU cycles and converting electrical current into heat, I guess. So if you want to read something from a database or you want to write something to a database or whatever, you'll always have some side effects. And what FP people do is they really, really clearly separate all the many functions that are side effect free that we can verify easily and have a few ugly parts that are really demarked and you put lots of like warning signs around them that those are somewhat more unsafe. And of course, like I said, high performance is possible. We have seen in some cases high performance even comes for free. Sometimes, however, especially in languages like Haskell, it requires some tweaking and a bit of unintuitive optimizations. And in conclusions, I would say FP overall makes some errors somewhat more harder. It's, like I said, not a magic bullet. In reality, I guess you always want to try to find some pragmatic balance between doing it quick and simply with imperative things as opposed to making it really nice with a nice looking and verifiable pipeline. And the concepts I've mentioned, I said that are useful in nearly all the languages. And what I recommend to you is if you want to explore this, just take it slow. Yep, nearly done, I promise. Would you shut up? My recommendation is take it slow. Don't force yourself to do all the things, all the bells and whistles at once. Just take maybe one or two things that you said, hey, that's cool, I like that. The filter command, it does what it do. I want to take that and just try it, play around with it, gradually steal those and run with them. And there's no need to do it from 0 to 100% at once. Just try to randomly play around with it. And I would argue if you take some of these concepts and add them to your code base, you may at some point say, hey, that works nice. I quite liked it. I want to do that more often. And then just gradually expose yourself to it. With that, I'm very thankful for your attention. You have been a really lovely audience. You laughed all about my dumb, silly jokes. I do appreciate that. Questions are always most welcome. Hit me up. I am on Telegram, not because I'm like a terrorist from Al-Qaeda or so. I just belong to the furry fandom, and Telegram is the de facto manager, so all the weird animal peoples are in there. I also have a Matrix account. I sometimes even understand how to operate it. I sometimes look into it as well. You may be able to reach me there. Of course, you can also talk to me in person when you see me like that. At many chaos events, I also run around like that. So if you need that feller, also do feel free to hit him up. I'm sure he will be most delighted. And with that, I'm done and I'm open to any questions. And thank you for your attention.
Questions?
So you made a very nice point about functional programming being useful for data science. But of course, one of the reasons people use Python or R for this is the large ecosystem of good libraries and stuff. So
absolutely.
Have you ever done any serious data science in Haskell, and how well did that go?
Well, in Haskell, that's the thing. There are lots of Haskell enthusiasts, of course, that they say, yeah, we also should do completely functional data analysis. And if you Google it, you see a few projects, but these are like typical PhD projects that were like half finished and then abandoned. So I'm totally with you saying doing a 100% completely FP diehard serious data science project in production at scale in the blockchain, in the cloud. No. Honestly, no. That's why I said, like, maybe just try to take some concepts, run with them, introduce them into your project, maybe start to appreciate them and introduce more and more of them. But I'm not quite convinced we'll ever be there 100% in production and everywhere. So I totally get your point and I entirely agree.
Just a little recommendation.
Yeah.
In Python, you can write these map and filter functions as list comprehensions.
Yes, I can.
Just one application, but it's
better
readable and smaller,
right.
And not like
I absolutely
many
agree.
Brackets.
Actually, you're totally right. That's a very good recommendation. And I first wrote this practical session in Python, and then I thought, hey, yeah, I can also do the list comprehension. Then I was like, no, then I have to explain that syntax as well. And then I have even less time for that. But for those of you who use Python, yes, there are list comprehensions. They're really nice. They are inspired by mathematical notation. And once you understood them, they're super easy and save you a lot of typing work. So very good recommendation. I entirely agree. I can also just repeat your question.
Oh, I got it the wrong way around.
Lovely.
All right. So thank you for sprinkling some R. I learned something tonight.
Ooh, nice.
I have a question regarding going like pure functional, diving deep in mm-hmm. versus being practical as you did
yes.
on the left-hand side,
yes.
where you picked Python and did Python in a functional style. And yeah. I've seen the same thing happening a lot in JavaScript. So what's mm-hmm. the trade-off there?
What's what?
The trade-off.
Well, of course, the trade-off is if you just imbue your code base with a little bit of FP-inspired things here and there, it's easier for you to get started. It's also not that you have to jump into the ice cold water all at once from 0 to 100. But of course, those places where you do not introduce them, you still have like the typical drawbacks and trade-offs you have whenever you do imperative or OOP style. So it's like a sliding scale of how much are you comfortable with, or like how much comfortableness are you willing to sacrifice to gain how much additional reliability or verifiability. And I guess, like I said, this is somewhat of a trade-off, and I guess depending on your experience and your personal feelings and on your personal level of masochism, you're able to endure different positions on that sliding scale. And this finding this balance and developing a feel at which situation, which point on that scale is an optimal choice, is like a little bit of a subjective judgment call.
Other questions? Doesn't look like it. So let's thank Yoto once again.
Thank you again. Talk.